Let's go, 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 White Sox! Chicago's proud of you!
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest has brought the history of the White Sox from the archives of the Trib Tower to the pages of a new book. The Chicago Tribune Book of the Chicago White Sox, a decade-by-decade history, is out on Agate Publishing. The Coffee Table Book features archival photos and write-ups of some of the best moments of the Chicago White Sox. Learn about the Black Sox scandal, the Go-Go Sox, the Southside Hitmen, Disco Demolition, the Wood-Ofs and Could-Ofs of the 94-strike shortened season, and of course, the World Series Championship 2005. It's a great read, and the visuals from the Tribune archives are stunning. Joe Knowles is the Trib's associate managing sports editor and the man who put this book together, plus four others. This has been a project for the Chicago Tribune to really document the history of all of Chicago's sports franchises. Joe, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
As a White Sox fan, you look at this stuff and you recognize that there are 100-plus years of rich history for this franchise that sometimes it gets overlooked.
Well, a lot of people forget, in light of the Cubs' 108-year drought, that the White Sox won 88 years between winning World Series. And in between, not many good things happened for them. They had some extremely lean years in the 30s, while the Cubs were pretty regular participants in the World Series during the 30s. The Sox went from 1919 all the way to 1959 before they made it back and weren't very competitive in the period in between. So yeah, that often does get lost, I think, and overlooked. The Sox have always kind of been the second team in the city, but in a lot of ways they represent Chicago in a different way than the Cubs do. I think they're a blue-collar sort of team. They're, you know, they don't get credit for being a founding member of the American League. They've really had a rich history with a lot of colorful characters, and I think the book shines a light
absolutely
on a lot of those.
The book, of course, like I said, is your writing, but also a tremendous collection of the archive of the Chicago Tribune when it comes to White Sox, dating back, you know, like I said, over 100 years. Talk about the process of putting this together. You're going down to the doldrums of the Trib Tower into the archive room, and you're handpicking how this book plays out?
Well, the photos are stored. A lot of people don't know there's five levels beneath Tribune Tower here, five levels beneath street level. And so Marianne Mather is the photo editor. She's the one who actually had to go down into the bowels there and dig out those things. And we're lucky to have that basement because it's temperature controlled. There's no light in there. So it really is a great place to store images, coincidentally. Actually, it used to be a bomb shelter at one time and was also used to roll big rolls of paper in from the ships off the river to when the paper was still printed here. So Marianne went down in there and just really dug in on it. Some of the stuff is cataloged really well and is easy to find, and a lot of it isn't. And also we had to be very careful with some of the older images. They do deteriorate over time.
Right.
Some way dating back to the Black Sox era were on glass negatives, which are very fragile. And then you have to really be careful when you try to digitize them that you're not going to damage them or hurt them.
Right.
So that's where the process started. And then what I did is basically you just start going back through the archive, some of which are easy to obtain and others which are more difficult are on microfilm. You start back with the history of the team, which in the case of the White Sox goes back to the turn of the last century.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah.
And you start to build a timeline. And then as you're going through that, you know, you think you know everything about a team's history, but you find out that quickly that you really don't. There's a lot of things you're unaware of. So you're making notes on that and pointing out different moments in that timeline that you want to expand upon and research. And then you stumble upon things sometimes, too. When I was doing the Bears book, for example, I found a series that was written for the Tribune by George Ellis about the history of the team, which was a gem. In this case, I found a series that we had done in the 70s on Dick Allen, who had a brief but very eventful stay with the White Sox, and it was really a terrific wealth. We could have done much more on him. There's probably a whole other book you could do
on
Dick
MVP
Allen.
Player, also reading about how, you know, the manager at the time had different sets of rules for him as the other team, and that was an issue. This is amazing history, especially when you come to some things that were overlooked or that people will remember but don't remember it so succinctly.
And Dick Allen was kind of a misunderstood player, although he was often portrayed as kind of a rebel and a guy who didn't like to follow the rules. When you read about him, you realize his teammates really loved him. He was a terrific player who put in his practice time. He just put it in when he wanted to.
Right.
You know, he didn't like to be around the press. He wanted to do things his own way, and you can't argue with the results.
Right. Well, we'll get into it because, you know, I got you for the hour, so I want to, you know, get into the different decades and draw the highlights. For you as a sports editor, I always love this too because you kind of become the de facto historian for sports franchises. If you work for the Tribune, the Sun-Times in this town, there's so much that people put on you to know the history, and you have to be, I'm sure, in many cases, if you don't know the history, the reader lets you know. But how does this project and the project of doing all the other books help you as an editor? It's got to help you better understand the product that you're writing about.
It reinforces your knowledge a little bit because over time there's things you just you may know, but you forget. And there's things you discover that you didn't know. You know, I wouldn't claim to know everything about the five teams, but certainly digging in on them the way we had to do for these books, I learned a lot of the background of stories that are somewhat apocryphal or become myth. You know, you learn a little bit more about the Black Sox, for example, and what went into that and how gambling was really pervasive in the sport. And the Black Sox took the fall for it,
right.
But it was really a part of a larger problem in the sport. So, yeah, you do become a deeper expert on the subject, and you find that even though you followed these teams for most of your life, there's so much more to learn about them. And so anybody who's a fan, I hope if you pick up this book, you're going to reinforce some memories that you were aware of and maybe learn a few things that you had no idea about.
Well, the book is the Chicago Tribune Book of the Chicago White Sox, a decade-by-decade history. Joe Knowles is the Tribune's associate managing sports editor. He's the man who put it together with help of staff. All right, so we'll take a quick break here. We'll come back and let's dig into Chicago White Sox history. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download Here 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, Joe Knowles. He's the Trib's associate managing sports editor and the man behind the book, the Chicago Tribune, Book of the Chicago White Sox, a decade-by-decade history, a coffee table book with stunning archival images and really a chronological history of the Chicago White Sox. This is a series that the Tribune has done with all the sports franchises here in town. I guess we start, I mean, obviously we talked about the turn of the century, the beginning of the Chicago White Sox and at the beginning of the American League. But the big story I think that a lot of people want to know about is the Black Sox scandal. When you dug into that, to look back and you talked about some of the archives being very fragile and to better understand that story, you mentioned about being more pervasive than we thought, sports gambling. But what did you learn about that scandal that is different than what you knew about?
Well, after time had passed after the scandal, a lot more research had gone into what had happened in the day, in the era that the Black Sox were playing. Archives had been found by Major League Baseball historians, and that sort of refuted some of the things that we had come to accept about the team. You know, one thing that struck me, you notice they win the World Championship in 1917. The following season, they suffer a 56-game reversal in fortune in the standings. Mm. They would go from a team that was 46 games over 500 to a team that's 10 games under in one season with largely the same players, although they had lost a couple players to the war effort, but they weren't alone in that. And then the following season, they bounce back and win the pennant again and make it to the World Series. And as I read some other books as sort of a background on the Black Sox, and you realize that baseball had a gambling problem that maybe was culminated by the Black Sox scandal, but certainly went beyond it. There was a player called Hal Chase who coincidentally briefly spent some time with the White Sox and was a teammate of Buck Weaver and Ray Schalk and a couple of the other, Eddie Seacott, of the Black Sox players, although Schalk wasn't implicated. He was a notorious gambler, openly consorted with people in the underworld, had been suspended by his manager and the Reds for bribing opponents to throw games that he had bet on. You just realized that it was a different era. You know, I found out, too, that the reason you had so many gamblers around baseball was during the World War One. During that period, the government banned horse racing and shut the industry down. So gamblers were looking for a place to go.
That's interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't even think about
it. They wound up at the ballpark.
And you say that, you know, the Black Sox kind of became the fall guy, if you will. Shoeless Joe Jackson, there's even a point where he says it's like getting this off of my chest, you know, in the piece. But it makes you think about the other teams that won in that era and baseball around that time. And you're right. The White Sox take the fall, and history will know them to be the team that gambled away the World Series. But there's still questions about some of the other teams around that in that era as well.
In the 1920 trial, when Eddie Seacott was testifying about the Black Sox scandal, he said in a deposition that he thinks the idea for it surfaced, from what he had heard anyway, an offer gamblers had made to the Cubs in 1918 to throw the World Series to the Red Sox. And he's not saying, he didn't name any names or say specifically that anything had happened. But if you look back at that series, which I did, and there's an interesting book out on that topic called The Original Curse by Sean Devaney, you realize those games were very close games, often decided by one run in that series and some very suspicious plays. Much like if you watch the movie Eight Men Out, you saw that the sports writers would circle questionable plays on their scorecard. In the 1918 series, there was a pitcher who came into the game and took a routine ground ball and threw it over the head of the first baseman that caused the run to score. Mm-hmm. There were some plays that, looking back on it now, you wonder if maybe something was going on there.
And you wonder because the history of the Chicago White Sox will forever be changed by this scandal. Whether, you know, there's movies like Eight Men Out or tons and tons of books about the subject. But other teams that may have also been involved in it have been able to skate free, if you will, and they haven't had this tarnish on their name, their brand, their identity, like the Black Sox of 1919 have done for the White Sox.
Well, that, you know, you have to remember, that set the franchise back, not just in terms of its image, but they lost some terrific players who were banned from the game for life. Joe Jackson would have been a Hall of Fame player. Buck Weaver was a tremendous player. Eddie Seacott was a player who, you know, led the American League in wins. When you lost eight key players in one fell swoop, that was going to hurt your product on the field. And also, you know, in terms of the way you are being portrayed to the public, it definitely affected them. And you could see after that, the Sox took a long time to recover. They were really down for an extended period of time.
Well, the book is not just about the Black Sox scandal. There's a lot of other things. Let's keep going. We'll jump a couple of decades to the 50s, to the Go-Go Sox, the next time that the Sox were in the World Series, which is 1959. And really, a year that is very interesting because this was a team that, you know, they made it, but not the best team in Major League Baseball by a long shot.
They might not have invented small ball, but they kind of perfected it. They were a team with really strong pitching. They had an excellent defensive team led by the shortstop, Luis Aparicio, second baseman, Nellie Fox, and a good center fielder, Jim Landis. They won a lot of close games. They did the little things really well and won the American League pennant, although they didn't fare well in the World Series. They were a strong team, and that carried over into the early 60s a little, but they managed to make the most out of what they had then, and it was a fun team to watch. My dad often talked about them. I was born in 1958, so I missed out on that, but that was a team that I think really kind of captured the city's imagination, and you know, the celebration with the sirens that went off when they clinched the pennant.
Right.
It was, the city was really hungry for a winner, and Sox fans in particular, because it had been 40 years since they had been in the series. So
that team as well is another team that personifies Chicago White Sox, its history and who they are today, because you're right, they were a scrappy team. They were a team that was an underdog team. They were a team that didn't necessarily have all the big hitters and the marquee names, but they were able to win the pennant.
Yeah, they had very little power when you look back on it, and that's something I noticed too in Sox history. It was a long time till they really had a proven power hitter. It wasn't until you had the likes of Dick Allen and Bill Melton many years later that you hit for power. The 59 team, a lot of singles hitter, no real spectacular players, although you could make the case for Luis Aparicio and Nellie Fox. They're both Hall of Famers. But Nellie Fox was kind of a, you know, he was a 280 hitter. He was a singles hitter, real good defender. Those guys played every day, and eventually I think they wore teams out. They just had good pitching and caught the ball, didn't make mistakes. And in a way, that is something I think Sox fans take pride in effort and in execution. I think they do recognize that and value it.
It is interesting, too, because you get into the 60s, which in baseball history is dominated by the Cubs because of the 69 collapse, of course. But Minnie Minoso comes along at some point. The Chicago White Sox are still relevant. As you said, at the beginning of the 60s, they're playing well. But we again, don't get a taste of any sort of winning really until the 70s.
Yeah, they were kind of held back in the 60s by the Yankees, who had a really strong team. Then the Sox were a decent team and good for many of those seasons. But yeah, it wasn't until the 70s where they sort of rebuilt the team, and you had got into the Bill Veeck era where he was kind of taking advantage of a change in the marketplace and recognizing that if he couldn't afford to pay top-flight players, and often he couldn't, they went into like a rent-a-player system, bringing in the likes of a Richie Zisk and an Oscar Gamble on short-term deals.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be a pretty magical year when they in the post-Dick Allen era, when they had the Southside Hitmen, you had a really exciting team that did hit some home runs.
Well, maybe we do that. Let me pick up there, take a break, and we'll get an update on tonight's news, because I really want to spend some time on the Hitmen, because there is something great about Bill Veeck coming back to Chicago. And the White Sox at that time, from the mid-70s to the early 80s, they not only were with the Hitmen, and you saw Surge, that's also Disco Demolition, but you saw Bill Veeck bring fun back to the ballpark. He becomes a huge part, not just for White Sox history, but Major League Baseball history, and we'll talk about that. Joe Knowles is my guest. He's the Tribune's Associate Managing Sports Editor. He also put together the book, Chicago White Sox, A Decade-by-Decade History, part of the Chicago Tribune book series that has done great coffee table books on all of the sports franchises in town. All right, we'll take a quick break, come back, and we'll continue our conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, Joe Knowles. He, of course, is the Chicago Tribune's associate managing sports editor and the man behind the Chicago White Sox, A Decade-by-Decade History, the coffee table book that combines Chicago Tribune archival footage and photography with the story, the chronological history of the Chicago White Sox. The Chicago Tribune has put out a series of these books, including all of the major franchises in Chicago. We're talking about the White Sox tonight, which comes out now. We left off the conversation with the Hitman, and the reason it is, that's an awesome time. What an awesome time, because that's when you start to get, not only is Bill Veeck come back, I didn't recognize that he had actually owned the White Sox earlier in his career, came back, but he just brought fun back to the ballpark, and it showed because the audiences, the crowd sizes surged for the White Sox after a pretty dismal showing at Comiskey for a couple of decades.
Well, a lot of the innovations that he brought to the game had a lasting impact, you know, whether that was the exploding scoreboard, that's the shower in center field. Now you see teams that have pools in the outfield. He really turned the broadcaster into a celebrity when you had Harry Carey doing the games. He was very much a part of the draw, you know. And for a long time, Veeck didn't have much else to sell but gimmicks. You know, he was running the team on a shoestring. He was not a rich guy by today's standards, by any means. And throughout Sox history, you realize that they've often been kind of in tough financial situations. After the Comiskey family sort of went its own way away from the team, they were handed off to different owners. And Veeck, when he took the team over for the second time, he did it just barely. He almost lost that deal to Edward DiBartolo, who was another candidate for the team. But he felt like he had to do something to create excitement in the marketplace. He knew the Cubs were probably the dominant team. So he was willing to try things, and sometimes that worked out great. The exploding scoreboard, I think, was a hit. Sometimes with Disco Demolition, it was
shorts.
An idea that maybe was, maybe not all that well thought out. And then you had the uniforms with the short pants, which you have to admit it was innovative. I don't know if it was something that will ever be seen again. But.
Well, the Southside Hitmen, they did bring back with the long ball and powerful offense and rent-a-players this idea of 1 year. Oscar Gamble only played for the Sox for a year. Mm-hmm. Richie Zisk as well, which is surprising. As a White Sox fan, those are names that are sort of tattooed on the history. Oh, these players have been around. They played for the Sox for 1 year.
But they made a big impact in that year. And that year was a year, I think, when a lot of people became Sox fans, I think, or at least certainly cemented themselves as Sox fans. They were not expected to do much. They were kind of a motley collection of players, but they really played exciting baseball. They were
this was
fun.
This was 77?
76 and 77, yeah. I would say 77 is the Hitmen year. They were exciting to watch. They were colorful, and they really created a great atmosphere at the park. It was a fun place to be that year.
Well, we'll speed up our conversation and get past Disco Demolition. You can find out that history somewhere else. I feel like that's everybody knows that. But you get into in the 80s, and it's the first time that the Chicago White Sox had won a division title in years, and it was Tony La Russa, and then we get into modern history, a winning ugly team that won the division by 20 games. That was when I started, I was 9 years old, started to enjoy baseball watching the Chicago White Sox with Carlton Fisk and Ron Kittle and all the Chicago White Sox, Lamar Hoyt from the 83 team, just clobbering the competition, of course, until they got to the Baltimore Orioles, but
playoff series. Yeah, a lot of things came together for him that year. A lot of those players you mentioned had maybe the best years of their career. Lamar Hoyt was really effective that year. You know, you think about players like Ron Kittle, he was rookie of the year, 30 home run season. He never really got back to that level. You had a strong pitching staff with Britt Burns and Richard Dotson, good young pitchers that, you know, had decent careers, but never really reached that level.
Why do you think, because they lost and they should come back, 84, of course, the Cubs did their thing, but why do you think that the White Sox didn't continue the success? Because they were a team not unlike the Cubs where they tried other things, but they weren't able to get back to that dominance that they had in 83.
Yeah, I don't think they had the depth on that team maybe to sustain some of the injuries and the losses they had to keep it together. It's an interesting question. And also, they made the decision, or Ken Harrelson made the decision, to let Tony La Russa go not too much long after that. And that was probably one he'd regret. I bet if he had his way, he might have done that differently. But it was a team that, in that one season, things came together quickly, but it seemed to unravel pretty quickly, too, and they never really were able to regroup until the 90s.
Let's get to the 90s. Of course, the 90s, Frank Thomas, of Hall of Famer, Ozzie Guillen, Robin Ventura, Bo Jackson. You start to get into some of these players where the 93 season, the White Sox make it to the playoffs, and then the 94 season. It looks like this is our year. This is where the World Series is going to happen.
Absolutely.
And, of course, baseball goes on strike.
Yeah, that is really an example of how cruel fate has been to Sox fans. I think they had the best team in baseball. And you're right, Frank Thomas was a Hall of Fame quality hitter, putting up numbers that were just unbelievable. They were strong top to bottom, good infield, good pitching staff. They really looked poised to go all the way, and then the season gets trashed, and there you go. What's left of that? You know, and after that, they were still a good team for a while, but never quite reached that level. That was kind of their year that they had been building towards.
And another part, and it's well done in the book as well, when you get to the decade of the 90s, is what's happening off the field with the end of Comiskey Park, which is the early 90s, and the beginning of Sox Park, which is now Guaranteed Rate. But the great photos of the building of that building reminding us that they had to do renovations because the upper deck, they had made mistakes in the way that it was too steep, mm-hmm. and people were having vertigo issues being in that's fair. But this was right when the White Sox were actually good again in 93-94. Where
they were.
Then they changed their uniform to the black and the white. And
beautiful
this is,
uniform.
Yeah, this was essentially all of these things coming together at once.
Well, they needed a new ballpark as much as I think a lot of us like the old Comiskey Park. It was starting to get dated. One of the things I think that you hear often about the new Comiskey Park is that it was sort of right on the cusp of a new trend in ballparks. You were seeing a lot of the retro parks starting to happen right after the new Comiskey Park. You saw Camden Yards and Jacobs Field and some of these other parks that had a little bit more of a distinctive feel to them. You know, if you could criticize the new Comiskey Park at all, you might say it's a little bit sterile and not very, you know, there's nothing really.
Yeah, well, they definitely recognized. It's almost like this was the trial and error of baseball. They saw the error of what was Sox Park and they said, let's bring some of that Wrigley Field charm to some of the new building. I also feel, as a Sox fan, and I'm biased, but I believe that the park and the renovations they've made, I love watching baseball in that
park.
It's
a great place to see a game. I mean, it's very comfortable and accessible. The food is great. The concourse is nice and convenient. It's still a great place to see a game. I think it just reminds people somewhat a little bit of the cookie-cutter stadiums that kind of flooded the market in the 70s. Yeah. And then if it weren't for the Camden Yards and the fields that came after it, I don't know that you'd hear much criticism about it because it's a good place to
see a
game.
Now, I'll ask the same question I asked of the La Russa 83 Sox. The strike season ended the chance for the 94 Sox, but what was it about the 95 team, the 96 team, the 97 team that kept them from regaining the glory? Because they, in 93, they took the Blue Jays, who eventually, I believe, won the World Series that year. They went to six games in that series, but felt like they should have just been able to jump up in 95, 96, 97, but it didn't happen.
Yeah, I think they had trouble holding their pitching staff together. I think they were also maybe a victim of their own success. I think that they ran into some contract issues. It just was, again, baseball success is pretty fragile. If you look over the years, how many teams have extended runs anymore where you're in the playoffs for 5 or 6 or 7 years in a row? It just doesn't seem to happen. I think it was just a lot of factors working against them, and the transition from a veteran team to sort of bringing in some younger players, it doesn't always pan out the way you'd like.
All right, let's get to the 2000s. Ozzie Guillen comes in. Let's get there, right? We're wasting too much time with the rest of the history. Let's get to the World Series season of 05, one that has been well documented because it has happened in recent memory, and there was a lot that's come out fresh in our memories, but also with documentaries and photo. So it's not a picture of Joe Creedy or Juan Uribe. Doesn't bring the nostalgia of maybe a Nellie Fox or a Dick Allen, but the photography is amazing. And when you think of the team in 2005, that harkens back to the 83 Sox and what they couldn't accomplish the 05 Sox did.
That team was really strong from start to finish. They faltered a little at the end of the season and allowed Cleveland to get close, but never really. After that was the last sort of bad streak they had. They went into the playoffs on a roll and just kept on going. I mean, dominant pitching from top to bottom, whether that was Jose Contreras or El Duque coming out of the bullpen. That series against the Red Sox, phenomenal. They went 11-1 in the postseason, which is a run I don't think is, it might be unprecedented. I don't know that you could do much better. Right. Swept the Astros in four games and did it with some dramatic,
so much game. Flair.
Some expected heroes like Paul Konerko and some unexpected ones like Scott Podsednik or Jeff Blum, who had a big hit next innings.
Right.
It was another case of, I think, a team that had good chemistry. You had a great heady player in A.J. Pierzynski. I don't think he gets enough credit for what he contributed to that team. He's always described as the kind of player that if he's on the other team, you hate him, but if he's your teammate, you love him.
Right.
And he did play with the drop third strike where he took advantage of a little lapse in the opponent's attention span. It was just a team, I think, that personified sort of Ozzie's attitude, too, of we're going to have some fun, we're not going to overthink things, and we're just going to beat you. And that was as much fun as I've ever had watching baseball that season.
Yeah, absolutely.
That playoff run.
I mean, obviously, watching the Cubs in 2016 was a tremendous thing for Chicago. I loved watching the, as a Sox fan, I loved watching the Cubs and what that brought to baseball. But bringing, harking back to 2005, there was something really special about watching what the White Sox accomplished in that run, because nobody even had them on the radar, even with their great season where they dominated American League teams. People still thought they were secondary to the other teams that were in there.
Yeah, and they went through a lot of changes even during the season. They were on their third closer by the time they got to the playoffs, and that was an unproven pitcher named Bobby Jenks. They started the year with Shingo Takatsu, turned it over to Dustin Hermanson, and then when he faltered or was hurt, here comes Bobby Jenks, a guy who doesn't, he looks like he's more comfortable on a bar stool than on a pitching mound, but he was almost unhittable for a while there and had one of those kind of seasons where when he came into the game, it was over.
Right.
And that was a really unlikely sort of development for a team. Most teams did not make it through the postseason with an unproven pitcher in clutch
situations. I feel like it's a broken record interview here, because with the 80s team, the 90s team, and even the 2000 team, once again I asked the question about why this team was not able to sustain. They flirted a little bit later with a playoff run, but every year they seemed to falter down the stretch. Ozzie Guillen, who will be a manager in White Sox hearts forever, also, on the flip side, was questioned for a lot of the moves that he was making and was run out of town with a lot of controversy. So where does Ozzie Guillen rank when it comes to the coaching icons of White Sox history?
Well, because he has a championship, he has to be among those all-time greats. That's the name of the game, right? That's the reason for the season. Ozzie, I think, you know, Ozzie has a high opinion of himself. Ozzie is not afraid to speak his mind, and I think he ran into some trouble when he did those things. You know, he liked to do things his way. I think he butted heads with Ken Williams pretty frequently. I think Ken Williams was smart enough to take a chance on Ozzie when he did. I think Ozzie was a little bit of an unproven commodity when they got the White Sox job, but I think he showed he could do the job. But now, looking back on it, you wonder if, you know, Ozzie was a little bit of his own worst enemy. He has not been able to find a job since, which is pretty remarkable for a guy who won a World Series, that you wouldn't think he'd get another shot. He got one in Miami.
Yeah,
it lasted a year. It didn't go well. It was another case, I think, when you, you know, when you talk about the history of the Sox, there are these brief periods of real big highs, and there's also, they're punctuated by these lows.
It's hard to believe that the Chicago White Sox have not been back to the playoffs since 2008. And this will be years, and that was a very short stay.
Yeah,
losing to the Rays in
they
the
got,
divisional.
Swept out of that series, if I recall.
This history of the Chicago White Sox. This idea that there will be these moments, like you just said, these high moments, and then long sustained droughts. 10 years to not even be competitive. There were some seasons there with Jim Thome and company where they came close and then they faltered down the stretch. But really, we're talking about 10 years once again. And, you know, the history is yet to be written on what happens to this decade. Of course, we're in a rebuild right now, but it follows the hiss. Very interesting. It's very cyclical.
When I wrote the introduction, I said to be a White Sox fan is to know the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. And I think that tells the story of the franchise pretty well. I think right now you're in a period where it's going to seem like a little bit of a low, but I think they're due for an upturn. They did something I think that was overdue, which was try not to just build around some older players and really get at the roots of the organization. Try to create a foundation for success. It's worked elsewhere. There's no guarantee that it'll work here, but it seems like the right thing to do and the right time to do it. So I think they're on the right track, and this season expectations should be modest. I wouldn't count on them winning more than 70 or 75 games, but I think Sox fans are smart enough to see around the corner and look at the possibilities for the future, and there's some good players on the way. Better times are coming.
Joe Knowles, thank you so much for being here. He's the author of the Chicago White Sox, A Decade by Decade History. He's the associate managing sports editor at the Chicago Tribune. And this is Chicago Tribune book, which is the archival footage of the Chicago Tribune about the White Sox. You're doing this for all the franchises. We could do an hour on every single one of these. Pleasure to have you here, and thanks so much for being my guest tonight.
Always enjoy talking to a Sox fan. Thanks for your time.